Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:40 p.m. on Tuesday, March 24th, 2026. And present today, we've got Representative Stapp, Representative Moore, Representative Bynum, Representative Co-Chair Shragi, Co-Chair Josephson, Representative Jimmy, Representative Galvin, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Hannon, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And just a reminder, folks can mute their cell phones. And we have two items on the agenda today, and that is House Bill 52, that's Minors and Psychiatric Hospitals by Representative Dybert. No amendments were submitted, so if it is the will of the committee, I'll entertain a motion to move the bill from committee. After that, we'll hear House Bill 262, that's the Number of Superior Court Judges by Request of the Courts. And this will be the first hearing on the bill. So we'll receive an introduction and review the fiscal notes, and then we'll set the bill aside. And so, again, if we can refer to House Bill 52, that's Minors and Psychiatric Hospitals. We've heard this bill twice. We've taken public testimony. We've reviewed the fiscal notes. No amendments were submitted for the bill. And so I would like to invite Representative Dybert, as well as her staff, Maria Alcantara, and then if you could both put yourselves on the record and just give us a recap of the bill. And thanks for being here. Also, we have online available for questions Mr. Matthew Thomas, Department of Health, Mr. Bruce Downs, Office of Children's Services, and Mr. David Flatten, Division of Juvenile Justice. So with that, welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Foster and members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, Maxine Dybert, representative for House District 31, downtown Fairbanks. Thank you to the chair and the committee for bringing this legislation back before the committee. I know we just heard this bill last week, but to reiterate, the main goal of this legislation is to bring more transparency to the ways our minors are treated in psychiatric hospitals in the state. And to remind committee members, the key measures of this bill include three things. The first thing is mandating a minor's access to confidential communication with their parent, legal guardian, or approved adult each week. And that communication is at least 2 cumulative hours. Secondly, requiring the Department of Health to conduct 2 unannounced inspections of each psychiatric hospital where they must interview at least 50% of the minor patients. Findings from these inspections, as well as data collected by the Department of Health, or the Department, pardon me, of Family and Community Services, must be included in an annual report to us, the legislature. And third, lastly, the bill requires the psychiatric hospitals to provide written notification to the Department of Health and the minor's legal guardian of any seclusion or restraint used on the minor. This notification must happen no later than 72 hours after the incident occurs. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to thank you and the committee again for your time today. And my staff and I are ready to answer any questions the committee may have.
Okay. Do we have any questions of the committee? Representative Tomaszewski and then Bynum. Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. So is this bill going to actually be able to be enforced?
Representative Dybert.
Through the chair to Representative Tomaszewski. Yes, we've been working very hard on it and working with the departments to make sure that this does.
Okay, a follow-up?
Follow-up.
So I'm just in Section 1, I'm looking at minors undergoing patient mental health evaluation and treatment. And for the telephone. So you said up to 2 hours. But, I mean, when I read this, It says they have the right, unless otherwise prohibited by law or court order or considered therapeutically unadvisable by the professional person in charge. So kind of like gives them every opportunity to not have the phone call. You know, if it's just the person in charge there at the hospital and they say, you know what, I don't think it's a good idea for them. I mean, are you going to actually going to be able to enforce that phone call when it seems like, I know it's kind of a, it's, it seems like a difficult thing to enforce, but it just seems like there's a lot of leeway to not allow them to have their telephone call.
And I like, sure. Yeah. Representative Dibert, and then we'll go to your trustee staff.
Yes.
For the record, Almarie Alcantara, staff to Representative Dibert, through the chair to Representative Tomaszewski. Section one, really what we're doing in there is adding in the confidential communication. So this communication does already happen between the parent and the child. I think the language that you're looking at, you know, unless otherwise prohibited by law or court order, maybe we could have a representative from the Department of Health speak more to that provision.
I do have on my script that we were supposed to have some folks available, but I don't see anybody online. Let me just double check. Is anybody else online with the Department of Health or anybody else? Juvenile Justice? Maybe there's some folks calling in here.
Someone is in the room.
Do we have somebody in the room who can, from the Department of Health? Okay.
And that's okay. I just, being this is a new section, I just wondered to know if there's actually going to be, you know, if they're actually going to be able to get their 2 hours with their parent or guardian. So.
And
Chair Foster, I'd like to hand it over to my staff. Sarah Snowberger.
If you could put yourself on the record.
Of course. Sarah Snowberger, Chief of Staff to Rep. Dibert. Being that I've been with her office since the very beginning for the last 4 years, I've seen all iterations of this bill. And I can tell you that this section, being a new section, it's only new because in Health and Social Services Committee last year, it was actually Rep. Fields who, we only had it for 1 hour, and he thought it would be better to do two. And this really came from the Department of Justice report, which is in the bill file itself. They were in the DOJ report, it was mentioned that kids were not having any opportunity to have conversations with their parent or guardian at all, for without somebody being there and was overhearing that conversation. So sorry, I know I'm going through the chair. And they just didn't have any private time without staff being there so they could actually speak to their parent or guardian. So this privatizes that conversation, and Rep. Fields added that second hour that they could speak to them per week. And this was something that DOJ thought that would really help out. There's also various reasons that made it harder that if somebody from the Department of Health, they've spoken to us about it before, and something I believe they would put on the record is that a lot of times kids that are in those mental health facilities, they are there maybe without a parent. A lot of times there's kids in foster care that are in these situations. Some of them because they actually need mental health care. Sometimes it's because they literally couldn't find housing for some of these foster children. So they stick them in to typically it's North Star. That's really the only option we have. It's located at Anchorage is the only one we have. There's a few beds in Alaska Psychiatric Institute, but I believe if they were here, that's why they would say that this is written the way it was. So I hope that helps.
Representative Tomaszewski, I think your question is about enforceability, and we do have Mr. David Flatten online with Division of Juvenile Justice. I don't know if you'd like to direct that question to him, maybe.
Sure. Thank you, through the chair. So my question is basically on section one there. Is it going to be enforceable? I mean, are those kids going to actually get those 2 hours of time to be able to talk with their parent or guardian?
Mr. Flatten, if you could put yourself on the record.
Thank you, through the chair. This is David Flatten, Social Services Program Officer with the Division of Juvenile Justice. Through the chair to Representative Tomaszewski, that would be an action for the Department of Health and would fall outside the jurisdiction of the Division of Juvenile Justice.
Okay. If we do have Matthew Thomas coming online with the Department of Health, I'll keep an eye out for that. Do we have any other, Representative Tomaszewski? Okay, I've got Representative Bynum and then Hannon. Representative Bynum?
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, Representative Dibert, thank you for bringing this forward, but more importantly, thank you for those that had come and testify in favor of the bill. And I know that there was a lot of folks that were in favor of the bill for very good reasons. I just want to say thank you to them for coming forward. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Hannon.
Thank you. I want to ask, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I'm going to ask Representative Tomaszewski's question, but in a different manner. And I think prohibited by law or court order, those are really tangible. We all understand that. But I want to ask the sponsor's office or the department on there whether the phrase therapeutically unadvisable by the professional person in charge has a legal ramification of them, i.e. it's not just the person on duty, but I read that to mean that the doctor or therapist who's in charge of child X has put this down as it would be unadvisable, not just on a whim of a decision maker for a shift, an employee who's on duty and thinks it's inconvenient. So does the phrasing therapeutically unadvisable by the professional person in charge have a legal or therapeutic definition that asserts this child's right to the confidential communication?
Representative Weber.
Chair Foster, can we see if the department has?
We've got Mr. Flatten online. I don't know. Oh, we might have somebody here in the room. If there's somebody. Oh, yes. If you'd like to please come up and put yourself on the record.
For the record, my name is Chrissy Vobley. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor for the Department of Family and Community Services. Through the chair to Rep. Hannon. So that language is put in there specifically, I believe, for children who are in the custody of the state. Frequently, we do have parents of children who are mistreating the children, abusing the children, traumatizing the children, and it would be therapeutically unadvisable for those children to have contact with their parents in the manner prescribed in this legislation. Therefore, that language is necessary in order to protect those children.
Okay, Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Foster. And a follow-up, just to clarify, it is not on a whim of someone just making a decision of it's inconvenient, but it would be in their case file, and it is language that is standardly used in cases for kids who are in foster care in custody of the state.
Through the chair to Rep. Hannon, that is correct. This would be a clinical assessment and also based on the case notes and the case from the Office of Children's Services. Mm-hmm.
Okay, do we have any further questions? Okay, seeing none, I would entertain a motion, if that would be appropriate, to move the bill. Froggy?
Yeah, Co-Chair Foster, I move House Bill 52, Work Order 34-LS0399/G out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Okay, do we have any objections? Seeing no objections, House Bill 52, and that is 34-LS0399/G, moves out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. If folks can be sure to sign the yellow sheet, Representative Dibert, thank you so very much. Any concluding remarks?
Chair Foster and the Finance House Committee, thank you for hearing the bill and for your questions and for your support for a piece of really good legislation to help youth in Alaska. Thank you so much. Anabasi.
Thank you very much. Okay, so with that, we're going to jump right into the next bill, and that is House Bill 262. It's number of Superior Court Judges. And I'd like to invite up Ms. Nancy Mead, General Counsel to the Alaska Court System. If you could come up and put yourself on the record and introduce us to the bill.
Thank you very much. For the record, Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. I appreciate the House Finance Committee hearing this bill today. This bill would add one Superior Court judge, and specifically that judge would be seated in Palmer, Alaska. For procedural context, the reason that this is a bill, House Bill 262, is because a statute sets the number of Superior Court judges in the state. So in order to add a judge, the court system must get that statute amended. Usually you might expect this to come through the budget or some other way, but the way we need to do it is to amend the statute and have a fiscal note for the costs. Specifically, House Bill 262 would amend Alaska Statute 2210120. A sectional seems a little too obvious, but right now the statute says on line 5 that the Superior Court has 45 judges and 28 of them would be in the 3rd District. This bill would change that to 46 judges with 29 in the 3rd Judicial District. This bill was introduced through the Rules Committee by request. It was not by request of the governor, which is what you're used to. This was the Rules Committee by request of the Supreme Court, which is why I am the person here speaking to the merits of the bill. One bit of background, though members of this committee may already know this, of course. The Superior Court, which this bill would add a judge to, is the trial court of general jurisdiction. We also have a district court that's a trial court. The judges on the Superior Court handle the higher level matters, such as felonies, whereas misdemeanors are in the district court. They handle felonies, they handle child in need of aid, they handle probate, such as mental commitments, guardianships, and will issues, all the protective proceedings, and they handle family law, all the domestic relations, child custody, divorce, dissolutions, paternity, as well as delinquency and civil matters where the amount in controversy is over $100,000. So the other case types, misdemeanors, minor offenses, small claims, evictions, things like that, are handled in the district court, and this bill would not affect those sorts of cases. For numbers, for a little bit of context, the filings in the Palmer Superior Court certainly fluctuate each year. Depends on what comes in, of course. But over the recent 5 years, they've fluctuated between about 2,650 and 2,950. So I sort of, in my mind, think of this as a court that gets about 2,800 case filings a year. Also, to paint the picture, about 30% of those are probate cases, which might surprise people. There is a facility in Palmer that handles mental commitments, and that means that there are a lot of mental commitment cases brought to the court just because of the proximity of that facility. About 25% are felony cases, about 20% domestic relations. Again, these numbers fluctuate. About 12% are child in need of aid, and the rest are basically a general civil. The judge that this bill would add in Palmer would handle all those case types. This is not just a criminal judge or just a civil judge. That this judge would handle everything. So why do they need another judge? Well, the most basic reason, Palmer, which currently has 4 Superior Court judges, is those judges carry the largest caseloads in the state. And what I mean by that is if you take the number of filings and divide by 4 to get the number of filings per judge, you come out with, for the last year, 683 cases per judge. The statewide average is 458. So that is a third more again, or a half, depending on the math that you're able to do. That is, it's also true that if a fifth judge were added, the Palmer judges would still be the busiest courts in the state. By adding one judge and then dividing by five instead of four, Palmer would be the first or second busiest court in the state, about in line with Anchorage, which is the second busiest, and still well above the statewide average. And this is not new. Palmer has had the highest caseloads in the state for at least the last 6 years, since about 2020. And in FY 21, 22, 23, the number exceeded 700. It was up to 740 cases in FY 22, when the statewide average was about 500. So the fact that we've had four judges hasn't changed, but it's the fact that the filings fluctuate and we are on the receiving end of that. So this request has been, in some ways, a long time coming. And it might be obvious, but the problem with high or excessively high caseloads per judge, which this bill would help address, is that the people in the court do not get the level of service that we would like to provide as a state. There is a lot of administrative time spent trying to shift resources to help out Palmer, and I'll get into that in more detail in a minute. But the constant shifting and the lack of continuity is very subpar for a community, and we would hope to have some permanency in those spots so that better justice can be delivered to those folks. The last time this statute was changed to add Superior Court judges in Palmer was in 2007. So 20 years ago, those four judges handled the caseload, and those same four judges are still handling the caseload. During that 20 years, the filings have increased by about 56%, and not surprisingly, in sync with that, the population in the Mat-Su Valley has also increased by about 58%, almost exactly akin to the increase in the number of filings. And the Department of Labor estimates that the population in the Mat-Su will continue to grow at least over the next 20 years. So those are the sort of the hard facts as to why it makes sense that a new judge would be able to help what's going on in the Mat-Su Valley. I also want to say that it isn't just case numbers or case filings per judge that affects workload in the Palmer courthouse. There are other reasons. For example, cases have become much more complex overall, certainly over the last 20 years. There's a lot of technology at play for evidence and for running trials. And, you know, the more technology you have available, the more people are going to use. The level of evidence has changed tremendously. There are text messages, there's phone dumps, what they call getting everything off somebody's phone. There's hard drive reading. There are scientists necessary at many more stages of a trial. And this is not just in criminal cases and divorce cases. There have been situations where a judge needed to take all the texts off of one of the parties' phones and had thousands of pages that needed to be reviewed. So with technology comes, surprisingly, a little bit more workload and more expert qualifications needed. A second change is victims' rights have expanded in criminal cases. So this is terrific for the victims of criminal offenses, but it also means that it's what another person that needs to be heard in the court, that needs to be able to express their views, and that the judge has to listen to and consider. Sometimes criminal cases might be postponed because the victim was unable to be reached to provide their input into something that the court might be able to do. So that ends up taking a little bit more time and becoming another level of complexity for the judges. In child in need of aid cases, there is now a policy which was not in place 20 years ago, called the One Family, One Judge. And that is, if somebody has a child in need of aid case and that child subsequently has a delinquency matter, or the parents end up in a divorce case, or a petition for a domestic violence order, these all go to the same Superior Court judge now, because it is considered best practice to have the same judge who is familiar with a family be the ones who deal with their justice issues all in one. But this means that some matters are unable to be handled just by a magistrate judge or a lower court, that the superior court judge needs to go to determine all the cases that a family might bring forward. In criminal cases, there are more charges for what we call VCOR, violating your conditions of release, and that's because now, since 2018, the Department of Corrections oversees many criminal defendants who are released on bail. They are supervised, and what that means is they are caught more often, and many more charges for violating bail conditions are brought. These are not reflected in case filing numbers because they're simply another charge in an existing case, but they are another whole incident that need to be examined and thought about. It can delay a criminal case, but it's certainly more work in criminal cases to have more charges brought after the case is underway. Anecdotally, 20 years ago, the practice of law was a bit more collegial. The lawyers would get along, were able to reach stipulations, were able to come to court with some agreements in place. That has not been as robust in recent years. Maybe it's a sign of other divisiveness in the community. But now, and particularly child in need of aid in criminal cases, but also divorce cases, there is a divide and judges are brought in to decide matters that previously might have been agreed to by the parties out of court. So the judges have to decide what happens when the child is not turned over to the other parent by 3 o'clock on Christmas Eve in time for the holiday. All sorts of matters that used to be worked out are now brought to the court for the judge to resolve for the parties. And that means more time spent on cases. The final example I'll give you as to why cases take longer or a little bit more work is a statewide issue, and that is the number of self-represented litigants. In family law in particular, not in criminal law so much, but in family law in particular, over 70% of the cases have at least one party who's representing themselves. Often it's both parties. So when people represent themselves, they still are entitled to the same type of justice, but it can slow down a case. They might file more motions more frequently than they would if an attorney were able to advise them on the advisability of filing the motion. They might bring up arguments that are just not related to the relevant legal issues. They might fail to submit the necessary information to calculate child support or property division, and they often are unable to fully explain the legal basis for their arguments, but a judge needs to work with them and ensure that they still achieve justice. So these take the courts longer very often. I finally want to talk about what the court has done. Since I mentioned that they've had the highest caseloads in Palmer for at least the last 5 years, why wasn't I here sooner? And one of the reasons is the court has tried everything to cover the gap in Palmer. One of the main ways is to try reassignments of existing judges. Now, this has mostly been Anchorage judges just because of geography. We have had the Valdez judge go up and handle some child in need of aid cases or even handle those through remote means. But of course, every judge has their own cases coming in every day. And that Valdez judge had a four-week homicide case in Glen Allen of her own, for example, and just didn't have the time. To my knowledge, still, the presiding judge in Anchorage, whose administrative task it is to ensure things get covered in Palmer, asks weekly at the Anchorage judges meeting whether any of those judges have had a case cancel or something fall off their calendar for some reason, whether they can give a week to go up to Palmer, whether they have time to cover a trial in Palmer. And that has worked somewhat. The presiding judge himself has gone up there a number of times. I think he had a multi-week large civil case once and a multi-week large criminal trial at least once. But that, again, Anchorage is the second busiest court with caseloads far above average. And it is a Band-Aid. It has worked, but it is not a sustainable solution. And frankly, the appetite for that among the Anchorage judges is waning. And what those judges do sometimes do is ask the Palmer litigants if they're willing to move their trial to Anchorage. And because the venue should be in Palmer, if that's where the incident occurred, sometimes the attorneys are amenable to that, often not. And really, you can understand why they're entitled not to have to drive to Anchorage. So that has been somewhat of a fix to try to at least keep those criminal cases from getting backlogged. A second thing that we've tried, the tool that the court has, is to hire back retired judges. We call them pro tem judges. And those retired judges can generally take, for example, a particular trial. What they don't do is sit up there for long periods of time and just take case assignments and take, for example, 1/5 of the caseload. Instead, what happens is a sitting Palmer judge might have two criminal trials expected to start on Monday, and unexpectedly, they're both ready to go. One of them would plea, but one didn't plea, and then suddenly you need a retired judge to come up and take that case, because we do promise a judge if the attorneys are ready to go. So that has happened a good number of times, but we pay those judges. We aren't fully funded to do that. And there are only 24 retired judges on the pro tem list. They're used all over the state. And if they're used all the time in Palmer, well, then there isn't one to cover a trial in Bethel or a trial in Juneau, for example. So that has been a fix, but not a terrific solution. Thirdly, we've tried to take the sitting district court judges, those are the ones that handle the lower level cases, and try to temporarily assign them up to the superior court to handle some matters, say the B and C felonies. And that works a little bit, and it does help with the criminal caseload. But there are three district court judges. They have about an average caseload. If you take one out of that, the other two are left with a tremendously high caseload. So that has not been as successful as it could be. But you can see what happens with the problem in Palmer is there's a ripple effect throughout the entire system. We can't then cover the Bethel trial with the pro tem. The Anchorage courts are backed up. I have heard that in family law, for example, parties from the MATSU are driving down and filing their case in Anchorage so as to avoid the long delays that happen in domestic relations cases in the Palmer courthouse. Again, that means that the Anchorage judges are handling more than they would otherwise or should have to handle. I just want to say that the Palmer courthouse, by the way, is in Palmer, but it handles all the cases from the entire MATSU Valley, Big Lake, Wasilla, you know, Talkeetna, Willow, Kinnick, all sorts of places. And so we don't view this as a regional issue at all. It is a large region that it serves, but the effects on the entire court system, the time it's taking for the presiding judge in Anchorage to handle is outsized. And finally, we feel it's appropriate to address this by seating another superior court judge. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
Great. Thanks very much. I think that some of the questions folks will be asking will have to do with the fiscal notes. I'd like to dispense with just reviewing those quickly, and then we can jump into questions. So Ms. Mead, I think you've got the first fiscal note on my list here from the trial courts. If you could just walk us through that and also note the control code that you're working off of.
Certainly, to the chair, I am looking at fiscal note with a control code of TY, V as in Victor, Q, Z. And this shows a cost for FY27 of $775,500, and out-year cost estimates remain at $680,000 per year. A superior court, to explain that, the superior court judge comes with a law clerk that is a range 13 who does legal research, usually somebody straight out of law school. So that person's salary plus benefits plus health insurance is factored in. Law clerks do not participate in PERS, so their benefits are lower because they're considered a temporary. The judge also comes with an in-court clerk, a range 12A, who is the person in the courtroom that handles documents and the court recordings and calendars and things like that. An administrative assistant, which is kind of like a front desk for the judge outside the chambers, is also a 12A. So those salaries, benefits, and insurance are included. The judge, him or herself, has their salary, benefits, and health insurance included. So that's on the personal services line. Each year, these people would need software maintenance and office supplies, $4,000. That's the commodities line. During the first year only, the extra $95,000 is because of the need to purchase for four positions, software licenses. That includes CourtView, CourtSmart, OnBase, which is our judicial interface with documents, Westlaw, things like that, furniture, desk chairs, computers, just like you would think, with associated printers, and the sound and recording systems for the courtroom and offices. They come with microphones and screens and machines to keep the official records, speakers, etc. So that is the explanation for the fiscal note. And I'm happy to take further questions.
Okay, we're going to jump into the other two fiscal notes, and then we'll come back to questions. I've got in the queue Representative Stapp and Bynum when we do come back to questions. The second of the three fiscal notes that we have, Deputy Attorney General Angie Kemp, if you can put yourself on the record and walk us through your fiscal notes. Ms. Kemp, are you there? Okay, we'll come back to Ms. Kemp. The other person online, I do have a Terrence Haas, but I believe the person walking us through the public defender fiscal note is going to be Renee McFarland. If you're online, if you can just put yourself on the record.
For the record, this is Renee McFarland. I'm the deputy public defender at the Public Defender Agency, and I'm here to discuss the agency's fiscal note. The control code is CFLYS. And the agency is requesting a total of $268,000 for FY2027. And this is to, to add a flexibly staffed attorney 1 through 4 to the agency to address the increased capacity the extra judge would have in Palmer. And so that is the personal services plus all the associated costs with that attorney position.
Okay, thank you very much. Rounding back to Ms. Kemp, Ms. Angie Kemp, are you online?
I am here. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. For the record, Angie Kemp, Deputy Attorney General for the Department of Law, Criminal Division, testifying for the fiscal note with the control code of YQBDO. And for the record, our request is for a position in Palmer and associated costs with that position, including travel, lease space, telephone costs, et cetera, and other core services. And the total fiscal note ask for us is $305,500. And again, that's for a single attorney position in the Palmer office.
Okay. Thank you very much. So now we're going to come back to questions. Is that on this fiscal note? Angie Kemp is her name. And she is Deputy Attorney General of the Criminal Division, Department of Law.
Wait till you're ready.
Okay. So in the queue, I've got Representative Stapp, Bynum, and Galvin, and we're opening up questions for Ms. Mead or any of the folks speaking to the fiscal notes. And also I want to note that we do have online James Stinson. He's the Director of the Office of Public Advocacy. So with that, Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair to Ms. Mead. Thank you for being here, Ms. Mead. What a wonderful, if not exhaustive, explanation for the need of this bill today. I was quite impressed. You preempted pretty much every objection I could think of with your excellent testimony. I do have two questions for you. Be remiss if I didn't bring up the Palmer Courthouse. If you want a judge, a law clerk, and a clerk aide, do we have somewhere to put them in the building? Because I know they want to expand that. And I assume we're going to be able to have additional caseload. What are we like on the square footage and space of that courthouse through the chair?
Ms. Mead?
Through the chair to Representative Stapp. As this committee is probably well aware, we have been seeking capital funding for expansion of the Palmer Courthouse since about FY23. In FY25, we received part of the request, a phase one funding of $7.2 million. Then in FY24, we were not successful at receiving additional funds. We still have that request in, and it's a top priority for the court system. We need this judge so badly that we needed to do something to provide space. So we pivoted and took some of that $7.2 million and are able to remodel and create these spaces within the existing footprint. The way we've been able to do that is the Palmer Courthouse has the executive branch criminal or justice agencies there as well. Somebody in the executive branch, I want to say it's probation office or something, moved out of the basement. When they moved out of the basement, the court was able to take that space, move the existing grand jury courtroom from the main level downstairs, and using these some of that $7.2 million, and then upstairs are able to create the courtroom and the judicial chambers and three accompanying offices for the staff. So for this ask, we do not need additional funding. And the remaining request that we have in the capital budget, still a very top priority because, as I mentioned, they'll still have the highest caseload in the state, and we expect that to grow in Palmer, would be to build two more courtrooms. And so we are still very actively pursuing funds this year to get that need fulfilled.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Staff.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. The chair to Ms. Speed. Thanks for that answer, Ms. Speed. Just wanted to make sure we weren't going to have to put the judge up in the Motel 8 in downtown Palmer, you know, had space for him at the courthouse. So second question is, I think you answered this, but obviously there's 45 current judges. There's no jurisdictions that you can think of that have too many Superior Court judges, are there, that we could simply just replace one from a different jurisdiction and add one to the Palmer jurisdiction through the chair?
Ms. Mead?
Through the chair to Representative Stapp, the short answer is no. I mean, we have our court system is maxed out. We will probably be back next year and the year after seeking more resources. The problem with asking for judges is, as you have pinpointed, Representative Stapp, they need a place to sit. So we have needed to ask for capital funds before we were able to ask for the staff to fill those spaces. So no, there is nobody in the system with excess capacity, or we would be trying to get that individual to help out in Palmer as well.
Okay, that's it. Thanks, Chair.
Okay. In the lineup, I've got Representative Bynum, Galvin, and Josephson. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. Thank you very much for being here today. Appreciate your presentation. It was very thorough, answered most of the questions. But when I think about the needs that you're asking for, I think that many of the things that we do here in the Finance Committee don't tie directly to constitutional items. So I know our Constitution basically says speedy trial, and Rule 45, Alaska Criminal, says speedy trial. By not having this judge available, are we encroaching upon constitutional rights?
Through the chair to Representative Bynum. Yes and no. One of the court's, of course, very, very most important concern is not to encroach upon constitutional rights. Cases are not dismissed because of a violation of speedy trial. That happens perhaps once, twice a year. People have a long time before trial because their attorney has waived the time because they have sought extra time because they weren't ready for something. On the other hand, we promise the court promises the parties and defendants that if the attorneys are ready for trial, we're going to provide a judge. That has become more and more and more difficult, not just in Palmer, but in other places, because people are stretched thin. We've been using those pro tem retired judges for that. So even though we have not faced having to violate somebody's constitutional rights, it is an utmost concern that we're always aware of if we have an additional judge. And as I say, maybe more in the future, there will be even stronger assurance that that will continue not to happen. But this is, in fact, something that the court system has to do, provide justice. And it isn't just criminal cases. If you're getting divorced and have a child custody matter, that's the most important thing happening to you in your life right then. And if you have to wait a year or a year and a half or 2 years before you know if your teenage daughter is going to be in your custody or your ex-spouse's, that is problematic for individuals. We don't care for that. And we're doing our best, but those are the cases because they don't have a constitutional mandate that tend to languish. So this is very important for constitutional reasons and just for fairness and justice reasons.
Follow up. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. I appreciate that. And I guess one of the follow-ups that I'd have to that is to ask, when you look at the history of the courts, or at least in your tenure, when you look at where we're at, would you say that we have the most pressure on our court system than we've ever had before? Would that be now?
Ms. Mead?
Through the chair to Representative Bynum, that's undoubtedly true. In the 15 years I've had this job, right now with fiscal issues statewide, and you know them better than I, this is an issue for the court system trying to give the best justice that it can give.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Galvin, Josephson, and Hannon. Representative Galvin?
Thank you. Thanks for being here. So my question is, in your presentation, you described what you're doing now to make do, essentially, whether it's pro tem judges or moving, shifting district judges. And so I guess somehow you're managing, and I know that it's completely unmanageable to ask these folks to continue in this way. Especially the judges who are covering, just trying to keep all that caseload. But what I was trying to understand is in the fiscal notes, the other two pieces, the need to hire more lawyers on the public defense side and on the prosecuting side. So are you expecting even more cases? Because I assume when you have the pro tem and the district judges, the lawyer part of it is getting figured out with what lawyers are already in Palmer, but I don't know. And I'm just asking that part of it. If you could tell me about if this is the typical ask when a new superior court judge comes into play, that also you need a new lawyer, these two lawyers that are added to the pot.
Ms. Mead?
To the chair, to Representative Galvin, the court system's fiscal note is the one that I described
right.
for the judge and the three accompanying positions. I have nothing to do with when the executive branch decides to put a fiscal note in or their analysis. So I would be afraid that I can't address their request or what their expectation is.
Is it okay to speak with Angie, I think, was one from the prosecuting side?
Sure. Ms. Kemp.
Thank you. Through Co-Chair Foster, I'm not sure if you heard the question, but it sounds like this.
I did.
The number of cases is the number of cases, and they've been covering through all sorts of patchwork. And what I don't understand is the need for more lawyers in this case.
Sure. Thank you. Through the chair, if I may, Representative Galvin, this is again Angie Kemp, Deputy Attorney General for the Department of Law Criminal Division. You asked a great question, and I will start by saying it's not the Criminal Division's belief that somehow there's going to be a measurable increase in the number of cases simply because of the addition of a new Superior Court judge. The issue is more and maybe best analogous to the situation that I think that you guys you've all heard me describe earlier. Just as Judge Mead pointed out, I'm sorry, excuse me, Ms. Mead, as force of habit, there is in fact also a Judge Mead. Just as Ms. Mead pointed out, that area of the state, the Mat-Su Valley in particular, is growing at a pace that none of us, I think, have truly kept pace with the court system, the criminal division. That's an area of the state where we continue to see increases in filings, as Ms. Mead pointed out. And it continues to be a source of concern from the criminal division. If members may recall, I discussed some of this in our presentation to the committee, the criminal division's presentation to the committee about caseloads and the caseloads in individual offices. Last year, for example, the criminal division requested a new position be added to Palmer because of those caseloads. For example, as of January of this year, the average caseload for PCN out in the Palmer office was 230 cases per position. So again, I go back to, I don't anticipate that we're somehow going to see a huge influx in that number, but that's already a number that is pushing the limits of our ability to truly work those cases and was a basis for the request last year and continues to be a source of concern. Again, I don't think that by adding a Superior Court judge that somehow we're going to have more cases, but what's going to happen is those folks who are working the 230 cases per attorney are undoubtedly going to be pulled into another courtroom and our resources will be otherwise impacted in our ability to, for example, work our cases, file our motions, draft our Rule 11 agreements, et cetera, all of the other things that go into prosecuting a case that do not relate to the in-court work, but we will be pulled into more courtrooms. I think of it as if you give yourself an example, if you have two prosecutors and two judges, there's some degree of predictability where we're going to be able to go and when and what level of resources we'll need to prosecute those cases. If you have two prosecutors and three judges, that calculus changes. So that's part of the analysis that I went through in measuring what the criminal division believes the impact is to us with this bill. And just to echo what Ms. Mead said again, this is an area of the state that we expect is continuing to grow if prior numbers are indicators of what the future looks like for us. So it is an area of the state that we're already, I think, generally concerned about and ensuring that we can offer the services to the state appropriately.
Quick follow-up.
Follow.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. So I think I'm tracking now. And my question is, Ms. Kemp, would you be asking for this if we were not seeing another judge come on? That sounds like there's a need in general, and I just want to ask that.
Ms. Kemp?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Galvin, that's a great question. This year, the decision was made at the start of the year not to put forward another request to add another prosecutor. And in part, that was largely driven by what happened last year in that the legislature elected not to include the additional prosecutor in our operating adjustment and include that as a position. So we made the calculus that at that point there was not an appetite for that, but it continues to be an area where, of course, we have a need, and that's why we're submitting the request with this bill.
Thank you.
Okay.
You bet.
Okay, and next up I've got Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Representative Foster. Ms. Kemp, I don't want to sort of beat a dead horse on this, but although in the conference committee the position you're seeking was cut, I mean, I know legislators, including myself, who suffer vetoes and we have setbacks and we just keep coming back for more. So I'm sort of, it's sort of, my question relates to what Representative Galvin said. If your department had simply said we need another two prosecutors, the chances of them being in the current budget are off the charts. I mean, they'd be there. I guess my question connected to what I've just noted is, there are going to be times, of course, when this new judge, if we create it, will be in an OCS hearing. That would be more perhaps for the public defender. They'd be in a divorce case, a restraining order case, a personal injury action, a contract claim. And your people just won't be needed in the courtroom, right?
Ms. Kemp?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson. Right. I think that is absolutely correct to say, and I want to make sure that the committee understands that I'm not suggesting that by adding this judge, we, the criminal division, will solely occupy his or her time. But again, maybe take a different analogy to give folks an understanding of where the criminal division is at. We felt like we're already at max capacity, we'll say. And if we use ourselves as an analogy to DOC's need to potentially open a new facility, by pulling us out of offices and pulling us from our ability to be in other courtrooms, for example, and watering down that work that's being done, at least arguably, the analogy extends. I think we're at the place where we need to, quote unquote, open a new facility. And the new facility in our case is adding a new position, because I do think that we have met the outer limits of what we can tolerate.
Okay. I guess I don't have much more. I am remembering, however, in around early May, the governor of last year said that the legislature should disregard all his ads. And that may have been a factor in the failure to adopt the increment you sought as well. Mr. Chairman, I don't have any other questions.
Okay. Next up, I've got Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Coach Foster. My question is actually for Mr. Stinson, if he's still online.
Mr. Stinson is online.
And that is because we have fiscal notes from sort of the other parts of the justice system, but we don't have one from the Office of Public Advocacy. And I am just inquiring. I am supportive of this bill. I've been convinced over the last couple of years of the need for the expansion of the court in Palmer. But I just want to make sure that all the costs associated with it are incorporated in the fiscal notes that we would be adopting if we move this bill forward, and wonder if the Office of Public Advocacy is late to the party or if they do not see an expanded impact in their office by adding another judge in the Palmer District.
Mr. James Stinson, if you could put yourself on the record.
Yeah, so for the record, this is James Stinson, the Director of the Office of Public Advocacy, and to Representative Hannon's point through the chair, yes, I'm late to the party. I do have a fiscal note that has been submitted, but I do not believe it's been processed yet. I can speak on it a little bit. It's somewhat of a unique note in that our Palmer office has a long-term non-permanent PCN that is stuck at an attorney two. It's a very difficult PCN to keep filled. People cycle out of there yearly. And so what I'm proposing is to essentially get replace that PCN with a full 1-2-3-4 flex PCN, just like in the public defender's fiscal note, but then subtract the cost of that LTMP from the total cost, which is about $94,520. So my fiscal note should come in at $94,520 cheaper than the public defenders. And I believe that would allow us to handle the anticipated increase in hearings. It's a mixed caseload for both civil and criminal. And also the Office of Public Advocacy is in the unique position of handling what's called Flores cases, which are actually divorce cases involving child custody to which we are appointed. So I'm sure there's going to be questions on that, and I apologize if the note is not published yet, but that is the gist.
Representative Hannon?
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, and thank you, Mr. Stinson, being forthright. I guess I just want to underscore that when we're talking about the cost of justice and the cost of serving Alaska, we want to make sure that we are not underfunding it and that we are making sure that the capacity to meet the needs of Alaskan is there, and especially you know, when we acknowledge that only 30% of court time is criminal cases and 70% are these much more complex, which is often going to involve the Office of Public Advocacy, cases of people's life circumstances that don't involve criminal court. And I want to make sure that we adequately fund this. So thank you. And I will be supportive of all the fiscal notes and this bill going forward.
Thank you. I do have Representative Moore next.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Mostly just want to say thank you, Ms. Mead for being here. And then maybe if you did such a thorough job, but I was just going to see on the record if you could just quantify the cost per case reduction this bill achieves for us, for Alaska.
Ms. Mead?
Through the chair to Representative Moore. I'm not certain I understand the question in terms of cost of cases.
Yeah. So the cost per case reduction, is this how much money is this going to save us over time?
Ms. Mead?
Through the chair.
By implementing these judges, sorry.
Through the chair to Representative Moore, I must misunderstand the question because I'm not recognizing how this bill will save money. It will provide much better service to constituents, and it will ensure that cases don't languish as much as they have by adding this one judge. But in terms of saving the state money, I must be missing the point, and I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah, that's fine. And we could talk offline about it.
Okay.
It just seems that, you know, we're asking for more judges and more time. You guys have, you're bringing judges to the Valley. We have, you know, constant asks and needs. And so I'm wondering if this position being implemented is going to be a cost-saving effect for us in the long term.
Ms. Mead?
Through the chair, I might understand a little bit better
now,
Representative Moore. No, I'm sorry, but I think what this will add is a level of efficiency. Right now, our presiding judge is spending an inordinate amount of time ensuring that Palmer cases are covered by calling up the retired judges, by writing up orders that temporarily move people here and there. The Supreme Court has to get involved with some of those orders, temporarily assigning judges to places. We are paying those pro tem judges, and we won't have to do that as much, although they will just be used elsewhere. So this is an efficiency and a consistency fix to a problem that's simply been bandaged over the last 5 or 6 years.
Yeah. I appreciate you being here. It's really, really thorough, and we totally support this bill. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, and I'm not exactly sure who I'm going to direct the question to, but I guess it's just in general question, is the way that I read the current bill, my understanding is that this is directive in law. It says shall. And so from a fiscal note perspective, The other agencies have put fiscal notes in here. We only have one from the court system, and my understanding is the only one that actually would be necessary to meet the requirements of the law is the court system's fiscal note, because this position is a shall. It shall be assigned, and then the governor would then also, the governor would fill the vacancy on the court. Is that an accurate description of the fiscal requirement and the obligation under the bill for appointment?
Through the chair to Representative Bynum, when the court submitted this for introduction, we submitted the cost that would be required by this bill. I would not be able to speak to what the executive branch thought or did or what this committee might think of those actions. All I know is that our fiscal note was submitted with the bill because those are necessary and required costs of implementing this statute should it change.
Right. And a quick follow-up.
Sure. Representative Bynum.
To the co-chairs. My understanding is our only legal obligation is the court, the judge in the assignment position. The other departments are requesting is them saying there might be additional pressures that would be subject to appropriation. But this particular item, because it is in statute saying shall an appointment of the governor, this is the obligation we would have then to meet that financial obligation. Is that accurate from your understanding?
So I think what you're asking is this is really the only thing that would have to be paid for. And in terms of the other fiscal notes, not necessarily, because one statute and one is, one's constitutional and the others are not.
Right. What I'm asking is that basically in statute, we're saying we're going to add a judge and the requirements, the cost associated with that judge. The other requests or fiscal notes are from the administration basically saying, we think we might need more people.
and resources, and those people and resources are subject to appropriation. This would be actually the additional judge would be something that we would have to take under consideration because we're trying to follow the law when that appointment is made. Is that? I just want to make sure that I'm being clear that the only fiscal note here that we would be obligated likely to have to put into the budget would be the one that's the shall, which is the judge. The others are the department saying, if there's another judge, well, we likely would see some additional workload, so we would like to have additional resources. Is that what I'm trying to get at.
I'm going to take a stab at that, but I'm just going to say I would imagine that everything is subject to appropriation, even if it was a shell regarding the judge. But we probably need our ledge finance people to maybe answer that. But I'm happy to listen to anybody's thoughts on that. Representative Stapp, are you're looking like you want to say something?
I was thinking maybe we could have a judge give us a ruling there.
Yes.
Judge Brody.
Were you asking for an Eddie's, Mr. Anderson, or okay? Feel free to come on up and yes, Mr. Anderson.
For the record, Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Foster, talk to the committee about fiscal notes. Fiscal notes move with the bill, according to the motion that is made when the bill passes out. It is with attached fiscal notes. The committee does have the ability to accept any of the fiscal notes that are in front of you that move through the process. The committee also has the ability to essentially kill a fiscal note and have it not travel forward with it. That is an option that this committee has. The committee also has the ability to introduce its own fiscal note written to address some of the concerns inside of it. So the policy discussion amongst the legislators, the committee members, would be to accept Alaska Court System's fiscal note to travel with it and identify their costs. Then another conversation would be to address the other fiscal notes that are attached to it as well, and whether or not the departments have justified the rise, the need for those as well. That has been mentioned by some of the members here as well. So there is options for the committee to address the fiscal notes. In the end, the fiscal note that goes through any bill that gets passed through this session during conference committee, there is a portion of the conference committee that has what we call the fiscal note package, and all of those fiscal notes that are attached to the bills that pass get lumped into this amendment that then will be approved by both bodies at the time of conference committee approval. And the conference committee can also have the power, based off of what powers are given to them during conference committee, to include and not include fiscal notes as well.
Thank you very much, Mr. Anderson. Going back to Representative Bynum first, and then we'll come back to
you. The reason why I brought that up, Co-Chair Foster, is that when we look at the caseloads that are currently on the judges in Palmer, it's 683. And if we add this judge position through law, that caseload becomes 546 per judge. So those are cases that the judges are actually seeing. What I'm hearing from the other departments, Department of Administration and Department of Law, is they're basically saying, hey, we've got another judge here and we're going to all of a sudden have additional caseload work. We already have a high caseload work. They're already at 683. So I guess I'm just a little, although it may be possible that they're going to see more cases or that they're going to have more work from the Department of Administration through the Legal and Advocacy Services and also through the Department of Law Criminal Division, I don't see that it's an absolute guarantee that those departments are judges are going to actually be seeing more cases because they're already seeing a higher than average workload. So, I mean, I would guess that if we were putting another five or six judges in here, then that might be true. But I'm just a little, it feels like to me that the additional fiscal notes are just kind of a hey, we want more money in the other departments, and it's not necessarily needed if we were to pass this law. I'm not saying that they don't need it in general. I'm just saying that if we pass this law and add the additional judge, that doesn't necessarily lead to the fact that those other departments and the criminal division and the legal and advocacy services would necessarily see the additional workload because the workload is already there.
Representative Josephson.
So perhaps I did, maybe it wasn't me, but maybe I was too effective, didn't mean to be too effective at asking Ms. Kemp some questions about the necessity for this. First, a comment. When you add another judge, it is absolutely, I think, undeniable and not subject to debate that if it's a criminal docket, you need human beings in the fifth courtroom. You need two of them. You need defense counsel and you need a prosecutor. There's no way I can think of to debate that point. So there is going to need to be more coverage within the building. And so I'm sympathetic in that respect. I just was – the fiscal notes cumulatively are considerable. My question is for Mr. Anderson. Mr. Anderson, you said that we could theoretically reject some fiscal notes and accept others. But that's not a typical thing a committee does, is it?
Mr. Anderson.
Once again, Brody Anderson for the record, staff to Representative Foster through the chair. You are correct, Coach. That is not a typical action that a committee takes. Usually we accept the fiscal notes. We rely on the department's assessment of their fiscal needs.
Follow.
And even though this seems like a standalone court system bill, which it arguably is, the fact that other agencies are saying and describing formally the impacts of the bill on them, that's typical as well, right?
Mr. Anderson?
Through the chair, yes, that is typical.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Representative Tomaszewski?
Yeah, well, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Co-Chair Josephson's comment kind of got me thinking. I wonder how many prosecutors and defenders do they have per judge? I can't imagine there's just one prosecutor and one defender for each judge. There must be a ratio that the departments rely on to sufficiently have two bodies in the courtroom per judge. So I'm wondering, does anybody have a answer to that question?
Ms. Mead?
Oh, to the chair, I do not have knowledge about how many district attorneys there are in Palmer. Perhaps the online folks would be able to address that.
Okay. either Renee McFarland or Angie Kemp, if you'd like to take a stab at that.
Go ahead, Renee.
Go ahead. Oh, no, for the record, I'll go next. Okay, for the record, this is Renee McFarland with the Public Defender Agency. As far as I'm aware, we don't assign our Palmer cases per judge, but our current staffing in the Palmer office is 12 lawyers, and they are fully staffed at the moment.
Okay, and Ms. Kemp?
So again, through the chair, and I think it was Representative Justin who asked the question. This is Angie Kemp, Deputy Attorney General, Department of Law. We are the same question or same response that Ms. McFarland gave. We don't assign, actually, that's not necessarily true. We do some judge-based assignments out there, but we have the same level of attorney staffing that the PDA has. We have 12 attorneys in the Palmer DA's office.
And for the record, that question was from Representative Tomaszewski. Follow-up?
My apologies.
Follow-up, Representative Tomaszewski?
No, I was just curious about that ratio, okay. Considering the statement that Co-Chair Jeff Josephson mentioned earlier. Thanks.
Okay. Representative Galvin, and then Representative Josephson and Bynum. Representative Galvin?
Thank you. Just a quick question. We already heard that the prosecuting attorneys have over around 221 cases, I think, on average. Do we know the lawyers who are in the DA office or the advocacy office, what the number of caseload is per lawyer on average?
That's for OPA, Office of Public Advocacy.
Yes,
and
please.
That would be Mr. James Stinson.
Yeah, for the record, this is James Stinson, Director of the Office of Public Advocacy, through the Chair, Representative Galvin. OPA's caseload is a little different than the public defender, so it wouldn't be a one-to-one ratio. For example, we also provide guardianship respondent counsel. Like I said, we also handle certain civil matters. The PDA typically doesn't. PDA does some child representation in China cases. OPA does more. So I could get you, typically I just go on the actual case types and case numbers for a given section to determine, you know, what level of pain they're under. I could get you that, but it wouldn't be as directly cross applicable. We also have a civil office where the public guardian section and then attorney and non-attorney guardian ad litems are housed. And so it's a different kind of work.
I appreciate that. I don't want to put any more work on you, frankly. Please don't feel like you need to report that to us. I believe you that you're very, very busy. Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Well, just a comment. Representative Tomaszewski has a point, for sure. It sounds like you could have 12 courtrooms and they would find a way to cover the 12 dockets. But I guess it's roughly analogous to being a legislator in this respect. Even though many of us are sometimes in hearings 6 hours a day, if you stretch that to 10, 11 hours a day, you'd never be on the floor. You'd never respond to emails. You couldn't have any meetings in your office. Something would break down. And so what they're talking about is that. They're talking about a breakdown of the functioning of the office. So ultimately, even though I wish they would just come through the normal budget process, because the need is there, I'm not likely to support the rejection of the fiscal note.
Okay. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Just wanted to clear for the record that my questions about the fiscal notes weren't trying to clear any fiscal notes or eliminate them. I'm just trying to understand what we would be obligated to as a financial obligation if we pass the bill. Now, I do understand how the fiscal notes give a recommendation from the departments on what their needs may be as we move into the future if the bill passed. But there would be an immediate need in the fiscal notes to pay for a judge. And I also want to just clarify for the record that I do support the bill. I think it's very necessary. I support your courthouse in Palmer. I think it is very necessary. And I think that Alaskan people deserve this level of service. So I support the bill. If you wanted to move the bill today, Co-Chair Foster, I'd be a definite do pass and would love to see it hit the floor so we could get it passed and get this into law as soon as possible. So I appreciate the opportunity to clarify my position on the questions.
Great. Thank you very much. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Foster, Chair Foster. And I appreciate Representative Bynum clarifying it because I look at it and think if I were advocating to, say, build a new ferry and the only cost we were associating with that was the captain, I would quickly say it's a promise unfulfilled to build a ship and only crew it with a captain. Now, the other branches of government don't work for the judge, but the system of our justice requires that we have public defenders, prosecutors, and public advocacy. And I want to make sure that if we are attempting to truly serve the justice system in the growing region of the Mat-Su Valley, then we need to step up and not just do it in a half-assed manner, that we need to fund it in the way that it needs to be funded to be able to function. And so I appreciate Representative Bynum's clarification of that. And the only reason I wouldn't want to move the bill today is I want to make sure that the Office of Public Advocacy's fiscal note is attached, and I want to make sure that we attach all those fiscal notes
when it goes to the floor so that nobody says, oh, we didn't know, because I think we know that justice is a costly thing in the 21st century, and we need to make sure that we are funding it adequately.
Thank you very much, Representative Hannon. I had received a few notes expressing some interest in possibly moving it, but I think your point is a valid one, which is we need to make sure we do our job and address all the fiscal notes. And also, I think we've had a good, robust discussion in terms of, you know, whether or not we want to, you know, include all the fiscal notes. And I think that's something that we should at least sleep on. Mr. Anderson, I think you want to say something? No?
Not after your last statement, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. We certainly don't want to rush it. And I think at least two meetings isn't asking too much. So do we have anything further to come for the committee? I don't see any. Okay. So with that, our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, Wednesday, March 25th at 1:30 p.m. And at that meeting, we'll take up a House Bill 21. It's voter pre-registration for minors bill. And HB 280, that is the bill formerly known as the highly digitized tax bill. Of course, we removed the highly digitized portion, so we'll have to come up with a new name for that. But with that, if there is nothing else to come for the committee, we will be adjourned at 3 o'clock. Thank you.